Okay, everyone, welcome back. This is the fifth lecture. I can't believe we're in the eighth week and this is only the fifth, but such is the way of things when there are holidays, when there is reading week. Anyway, we're going to move on today. We're going to discuss the transition from Old to Middle English, and today we're going to discuss it particularly from the perspective of language contact. So we're going to be looking at external influences on the English language, with a particular focus on this transition from the old stage to the middle stage. And here there are various languages in question. Today we're going to talk about Celtic influence, Latin influence, and Norse influence, and then we're going to come back next time to Anglo-Norman and French influence, because that's mostly visible a bit later. The fact that we're focusing on external changes today doesn't mean that all changes were triggered by some sort of external influence, that all changes were triggered by English coming into contact with another language in this way. There were, of course, internally motivated changes, and we're going to talk more about those in the weeks to follow. The big question when we look at Middle English, and this is a sneak preview of what we're going to talk about with the morphology of the language next week, is that all of these endings that make the Old English system so German-like and so wonderful, these all disappear. And one of the big questions is, where did they go and why? So what happened to all of this inflectional morphology? So I've shown you this already. Here we've got a timeline of contact influences on the English language. We see that the very early stages of English are marked by Latin influence. We've got some Celtic influence. Once English arrives in the British Isles, that is this point here, traditionally said to be from 449. And then we've got Norse influence later on. After 1066, after the Norman conquest, we start getting influence from Latin again and also from French. In later times, we have other influences too, but those are not going to be our focus today. We're going to focus on these first three, Latin, Celtic, and Norse, the influences that we find during the Old English period itself. So first of all, focusing on Celtic. What do I mean by Celtic languages? Well, this is a subfamily of the Indo-European languages. It was once spoken really very widely, and now it's spoken much, much less. So it's associated archaeologically, for those of you who are interested in such things, with the Hallstatt and Latin cultures. And now, the places where Celtic languages are spoken are only the far western places in the British Isles, essentially along the Atlantic coast. The Celtic languages, of course, were spoken in Britain before Germanic. We've seen that when the Anglo-Saxons arrived in Britain, there were people there already, and those people would have been speaking, in all likelihood, all of them would have been speaking some sort of Celtic language, or at the very least, most of them. If you're interested in the genetic angle on this, see Sykes's book, Blood of the Isles, which gives an overview of the population movements based on DNA evidence. Although there are some caveats to that. For instance, what he calls Celts and what we want to call Celts might not necessarily be the same thing. What we do know from archaeological evidence is that the Celts and the Germanic populations coexisted. And this is something that much, much earlier in the history, in the storytelling of the history of the English language, people didn't really admit to. So it was earlier thought that the Celts were basically all killed or driven off by the Anglo-Saxons as soon as they arrived. We now know that that didn't happen. We can look at burial practice, we can look at archaeological evidence. If the Celts really were all killed, we'd expect to see mass graves somewhere, or at least some evidence of what happened to all of the bodies. We don't find anything, which suggests that maybe those people weren't brutally killed in the way that people previously thought. And there's also evidence from the word werch, which means foreigner or slave or Briton. It's an interesting range of semantics there. And this is reflected in various place names. It's also related to the word welsch in German, as in Rotwelsch and Kauderwelsch. These are the same root, but this evidence is very interesting because what it shows, what it suggests, is that there was some degree of population mingling, with the Celts having a lower status than the Anglo-Saxons once the Anglo-Saxons arrived on the British Isles. Here's the rough locations of the present-day languages. In Ireland, we've got Irish. In Scotland, we've got Scots Gaelic, but that doesn't survive across the whole of Scotland, only in the northern and northwestern isles and along the far northwestern coast. We've also got Welsh spoken in Wales, again, not spoken in all of Wales. If you see the blue circle on the slides here, it's actually only really spoken with any great frequency in the north and in the west, so in the top end of Wales. The other Celtic language that survives is Breton, which is spoken right down here at the bottom in essentially in France, in Brittany. And that originates actually in the British Isles. It comes from Cornish speakers from the southwest of England moving to the continent. There are also two other marginal languages from the Celtic family that still survive. There is Celtic, there is Cornish, which is spoken in Cornwall, and there is Manx, which is spoken on the Isle of Man. Or rather, they're kind of spoken because they also kind of died out and kind of still exist and are kind of being revived. So there are people who speak these languages, but if we want to consider them living languages, then they're living languages that have had a very narrow escape, a very close brush with death. So on the whole, the Celtic languages are not widely spoken, which is interesting because at one stage they would have been hugely widely spoken all across Europe. Now within the Celtic languages, we can identify different phases of lexical influence. So these are just words that have been brought from Celtic into the Germanic languages. Phase one, we can consider words that are loaned into West Germanic. So this is actually, these are Celtic loanwords from before the Anglo-Saxons moved to the British Isles. And there aren't very many of these words, but some of them nowadays are very high frequency, such as car. The word car comes, in fact, from the Celtic languages that would have been spoken in Western Europe before the Anglo-Saxons moved to the British Isles and before those Celtic languages died out. So that's phase one. These are very, very early loans. Also words like beak, the beak of a bird, and a lance, the weapon. Then we can divide the loans into pre-1400 and post-1400. And here there are quite a few, but most of these loans are for very, very specific things. So Druids, for instance, that's a particular, this is a kind of priest, if you like, that is somewhat oversimplifying a complex role, but this is basically what these guys were. Also the word cross, the word story, these are very, very early loans into the English language, pre-1400. So when we look at the first phase, the words, in fact, the words car and lance come probably via Latin, and Latin itself probably borrowed these words from Celtic. So these are not direct borrowings from Celtic, rather they are mediated by Latin. And so that's car and lance. We don't know. Beak probably comes in actually via French, in fact, from continental Celtic. And the word dun, meaning a hill, might be borrowed from Celtic into Germanic at a very earlier stage as well. And for all of these external influences on the English language, you can look at Miller's book from 2012, which is available in the semester apparat, if you're interested in that. There are also a bunch of names for things that come specifically from Celtic languages. This is very often the case, and if you look at British place names, they reflect Celtic influence much more than the rest of the language does, in fact. But we see names, for instance, like the River Rhine. That is a word that comes from Celtic originally, and the Danube too. These very, very old borrowings into Germanic. We can see that because they're still alive. The cognate words are still alive in German too, which is why we talk about the Rhine and the Donau. Similarly, cognac, the name of a particular drink, this comes from Celtic as spoken on the European continent as well. So that's phase one. Phase two, now here we're talking about Brythonic Celtic. There are two groups of Celtic languages. There are essentially the Goidelic languages, which are spoken in the north. So that is nowadays Scottish, Gaelic, and Irish. Those are the Goidelic languages. And there are the Brythonic languages, which are Welsh and Breton. So, and the Brythonic languages would have been the ones that were spoken in England and Wales during the main historical period that we are interested in, pre-1400. And again, most of these places that we are interested in are have place names. Most of these words that we're interested in are place names. There are several rivers in Britain called the River Avon. So you probably know about, if you know anything about Shakespeare, William Shakespeare, you'll know that he was born in Stratford-on-Avon. And Avon is the name of the river that runs through Stratford. And Avon, in Brythonic Celtic, essentially just meant river. So the River Avon, this is essentially the river. So they've taken the Celtic word and they've used it as a name rather than a descriptive label. Similarly, Dover, the port in the south of England, this comes from the Celtic word dŵr, meaning water. So it's the place on the water, basically. Other very well-known names probably also arose through Celtic sources. So Cardiff, Belfast, Kent, the River Thames probably comes from a Celtic source, and most strikingly, perhaps, London. This, the name of London also is Celtic in origin. Other than that, we have a few landscape terms. So we see terms like cairn, glen, loch, dolmen. Look these up if you're interested. They are basically landscape features, and it's not as if these terms are necessarily used throughout the whole of the country. So glen, for instance, is a term that is very rarely used outside the Goidelic Celtic-speaking area. So it's you find it in Ireland, in Scotland, and you find it on the Isle of Man, for instance, but you don't find it everywhere. The other place where we see influence from Celtic is loanwords through Christianization of Northern England, because the Northern English, the Angles, who settled in places like Northumbria in the north of England, they got their Christianity from the Celts. And the Celts that they got their Christianity from were specifically the Irish. So the Irish, the missionaries came from Ireland, they were Celtic speakers, and that's where Old English gets the word dru, which is a druid or a magician, and the derived word dru kraft, so druid power, literally. So this means magic, essentially, sorcery. So these are a few of the early loans in the English language from Celtic. But on the whole, these are fairly peripheral compared to the other sources of lexical influence that we will see later on. What's more interesting is the question of potential invisible influence from Celtic on Old or Early Middle English. And in fact, this could have been going on during exactly the same time. And this kind of influence would have been going on in the syntax and the morphology particularly. So here we've got four types of syntactic feature that are very characteristic of English, but not so characteristic of the other Germanic languages, or at least not of the West Germanic languages. So we have prepositions for expressing an ongoing action. So say in Old English, you would say something like, I am on hunting. You also get the progressive, which is a very characteristic feature of present-day English. You get dummy do arising, and cleft sentences like, it is X that Y. So it is Celtic that she is learning, for instance. And all of these have been argued to originate through Celtic. And this is very plausible when we think about the circumstances under which this language contact would have arisen, because the dominant theory among historians and archaeologists now is that there are a lot of Celts around, and that there was a kind of elite dominance. The Anglo-Saxons, when they arrived, they were in charge, but they didn't represent the bulk of the population. Now, that would have led to a lot of Celtic speakers learning English essentially as a second language. And that could have led to them importing some of their Celtic features into the English that they were speaking. The trouble is, it's quite hard to be sure about any of this because we don't know how much this kind of change would be reflected in the texts. And some of the changes that are described here are not changes that we in fact see until middle or even early modern English in their modern form. There is still a debate about which features come from Celtic and which features don't. And this just goes to show that the history of the English language, it may be a dry field in some respects, but there are still lively scholarly debates going on in the field, and by no means everything is settled. Now, if you're interested in this kind of question, I usually offer a She 3 course in the summer semester, which is about precisely this question, about contact between English, Celtic, and Scandinavian in the early period of the history of the English language. So that's just a little advertisement if you want to explore that more later on in your academic career. But for now, if you want to read more, I'd suggest that you take a look at the first part of this book by Philpula et al., which you can also find in the Semester Apparat. Okay, are there any questions? No? Okay, in that case, we'll move on to talk about Latin influence. So Latin is always, in a way, the elephant in the room when you talk about historical language contact, because Latin in Europe was absolutely everywhere. Wherever the Roman Empire had set foot, and in some cases beyond, Latin was used as a vehicular language, especially in the corridors of power. It was used politically, it was used academically, it was used religiously, and in these roles, it was tremendously important. But what is Latin? What are we talking about when we talk about Latin? Like the Celtic languages, Latin is Indo-European, which means it's related, albeit distantly, to these other languages. Celtic is related to Latin. Latin is related to English, German. All of these languages that we'll be dealing with on this course are part of the Indo-European language family. We have evidence of Latin from 2,500 years ago at the earliest. And what we know about Latin is that it spread with the political influence of Rome, with the Roman Empire. And once again, we can talk about various different stages of contact. So like Celtic, we know that Latin was in contact with West Germanic on the continent, so before the Anglo-Saxons came to the British Isles. And from this period, we have about 170 words that we can reliably reconstruct as having originated in Latin. British Latin also would have been spoken in Britain during and after the Roman occupation. So within Britain, there was a variety of Latin that would have been spoken. British Latin as spoken would have been a variety of what's called Vulgar Latin. This is the kind of Latin that people actually spoke during the later days of the Roman Empire rather than writing down. So it's not the standard language, rather it is the everyday Umgangssprache of the Roman Empire. That was British Latin, and we have over 100 words that we can reliably reconstruct as having originated in British Latin as well. And then after that, when we get the Renaissance and when we get more French influence after the Norman Conquest, Latin influence goes completely insane in the history of English. It just explodes. We've got thousands of words. But for now, we're just going to talk about the early ones. The later ones were controversial in interesting ways, and we'll come back to that when we talk about early modern English. But what's important for us now is the Christianization process. Because, as I mentioned earlier, some of the Angles in northern England were Christianized by Irish missionaries, Celtic speakers. But most of the Anglo-Saxons were Christianized by a different route. And the story goes that Pope Gregory, was wandering around the slave market. I don't know what he was doing there. Presumably he was trying to do some good works. That's what popes are supposed to do. And he met some Angles. And he said, wow, these Angles are interesting people. I'm going to convert them to Christianity. And so he sent a bunch of missionaries. These missionaries arrived at the very end of the 6th century. And King Athelbert of Kent takes them into his court and welcomes them there. This is recorded in contemporary texts. So the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle describes all of this happening. Also, Bede's History of the English Church describes these events. And during this period, we have about 150 words borrowed from Latin into Old English. Now, you might ask, how do we know when these words are borrowed? How do we know whether it's a very early loan or it's a very late loan? And the answer is, we can use what we already know about Old English. So here's a reminder of two sound changes that affect the English language during the relevant period. You've got breaking, which causes front vowels to become diphthongs in certain contexts, that is, before certain kinds of consonant. And you've got fronting, or iumlaut, which causes back or low vowels to become fronted. They move towards the front of the mouth, towards the front of the vowel quadrilateral, if there is an e or a y in the following syllable. And we can use this kind of logic to figure out whether a loan is early or not, because we can tell when breaking and fronting took place. Therefore, if a loan contains breaking or fronting, it must have already been in the English language at the time that breaking or fronting took place, and that was the 7th century. So words that don't contain breaking or fronting must be later. So if we take the word unche, which is the word for an inch, measurement, this comes from the Latin word untia, and this Latin word doesn't contain fronting, it contains a back vowel, u, but the English word contains a front vowel, a front rounded vowel, u. This corresponds to a u with an umlaut on it in German. And that means that this word must be an early loan. It must have entered the language before the 7th century. On the other hand, we can look at the word falsch, which we find in Old English, which means false, not true. And this comes from the Latin word falsus. Now, what we see in this word is that the environment for breaking is present, right? There is the letter L followed by a consonant. So if breaking had taken place, what would we expect to find here? Something like fals with a diphthong, with an air diphthong, because that's what breaking does. It creates diphthongs. But we don't see it, which means that this loan must have entered the language after the sound change of breaking took place. That means after the 7th century. If in doubt, you can use the Oxford English Dictionary, and the Oxford English Dictionary itself bases its reasoning on this kind of evidence. But you, most of the time, will not have to do that because you can just look it up online, except when you're in the exam, in which case you can't. Then you have to just know it. We also find another interesting phenomenon in the early Germanic language, in the early Germanic contact influences from Latin, and these are loan translations. So sometimes the parts of a word are translated following a Latin model, even if the word itself is not borrowed. For instance, Latin has the word unicornus, and then unicornus is this friendly pink creature up here, right, which definitely exists. And unicornus literally means one horn. Why? Because it's got one horn, right? That's why it's called an unicornus. Now, Old English didn't borrow the word unicornus. That's what we have in modern English, right? Unicorn. But Old English had its own word, which was the translation of the two parts of this word. So an, which is the Old English word for one, and horn, which speaks for itself. So in Old English, we have the word anhorn, which is our word for a unicorn in the Old English times, and other Germanic languages do exactly the same thing. So this kind of loan translation is something that we see throughout the the Germanic languages when they come into contact with Latin. Another example of that is the Latin Trinitas, Trinity. Literally, this means threeness, the abstract quality of being three, and that's how Old English translates it. So English just has the word threeness, and that is the word for the Trinity in Old English. Again, in modern English, we just use the word Trinity, but that is because English, during the Renaissance and beyond, went absolutely mental and decided to borrow loads and loads and loads of words from Latin directly, rather than using loan translations. But loan translations are very, very productive in this early period of the English language. So what happens to these loan words? Well, usually they are phonologically adapted. So the Latin word candela, which is a candle, this gets borrowed into Old English as candle. What happens here is that the stress moves from the second syllable to the first syllable. Similarly, Latin cometa gets borrowed into Old English as cometa, with the stress on the first syllable. And remember, Old English is a language that likes to stress things on the first syllable. So Old English adapts loanwords when they are found. So loanwords are borrowed into the language, and they get phonologically adapted to the existing structure of Old English. Now, later loanwords, so loanwords after the Middle English period, don't usually undergo this process to the same extent. So later loanwords are much more rarely phonologically adapted, and this is another way that we can try and figure out whether a Latin loanword is early or late. We can try and tell whether it is borrowed very early or very late. Sometimes you get the same word being borrowed twice. So the word magister is borrowed into Old English, or perhaps earlier, because what we know about magister is that the G in the middle undergoes palatalization in English. So it becomes magister. And this is the same word that we find, and this is a word that we find very robustly, because it becomes the word master in modern English. But the word magister is also reborrowed. So this is a much more learned word. You don't find it so often in low register context, but people occasionally do talk about magisters in a separate context, for instance, in a legal context. The same word can be borrowed twice from the same language at different points in its history. Now, the early domains that we find Latin influence, we can say these loanwords aren't all over the language. They're not in every single domain. We find them in very specific areas. So particularly we find them in the commercial domain, in the military domain, in the religious domain, that's perhaps the most dominant of all, and also for certain cultural phenomena. So a few of the more common Latin loanwords are given in the box here. What's interesting about Latin influence is that it's essentially only on the lexical level. We don't really have any evidence that Latin influence would have been felt, for instance, in the phonology, in the morphology, in the syntax, anywhere other than in the lexicon. So Latin influence in the early period is actually very restricted. There are a lot of words borrowed from Latin, perhaps more than in any other language, than from any other language, but this influence is restricted to the lexicon, and that makes sense, because these people would largely not have been in contact with Latin speakers. They would have been in contact with Latin in a very high context. They would have been in contact with Latin through writing, but largely not through speech itself. All right, so we will now talk about the perhaps most violent and aggressive type of language contact influence in the early period, that is Norse influence. So what are we talking about when we use the term Norse? Well, in the literature, this term is used fairly loosely, and different terms are used to refer to roughly the same thing. Old Norse, Anglo-Norse, Anglo-Scandinavian, Old Scandinavian. Basically, what we're talking about North Germanic languages. So these languages are even more closely related to Old English than Latin or Celtic. They're not just Indo-European languages, they are Germanic languages. In terms of the history of these developments, what we find is that during the 8th century, people from the present-day Norway, Denmark, and Sweden start to trade and to settle in other areas of Europe, including the British Isles. And actually, trading and settling was not all they were doing. They were also raiding and pillaging. And in the 9th century, you get Danes settling in the east of England. So the Scandinavians who settle in the east of England are specifically from Denmark, present-day Denmark. And in the 10th century, we get Norwegians settling in the northwest of England as well. Now, the problem with trying to figure out what influence this language had, this Norse language had on English, is that we really have very little evidence for the kind of English, for the kind of Norse that was spoken in the British Isles. We have good evidence for the kind of Norse that was spoken in Iceland, and reasonable evidence for the rest of Scandinavia as well. But from what we find in the context of the British Isles, we have a few very fragmentary inscriptions, and so it's difficult to tell. Nevertheless, by comparing English, Old and Middle English, with the other Scandinavian languages that we see today, we can draw reasonably good inferences about what must have been borrowed or transferred. One interesting feature of the Norse-English relation was that these two languages were probably to some extent mutually intelligible. In other words, these Danes who settled in the 9th century in eastern England and northern England probably could to some extent understand the English that was being spoken at the time, and vice versa. That is what is meant by mutual intelligibility here. They by no means spoke the same language in any sense of the word, but it was probably true that they could understand each other if they spoke slowly and restricted themselves to relatively straightforward shared vocabulary. And because a large part of this early relationship was based around trade, that was probably exactly what happened. And now with Norse, in contrast to Latin, we find that contact clearly affected not only the lexicon of the language, but also the grammatical system of the language. So the morphology and the syntax are also affected. And there are roughly 1,000 loanwords that we can safely say come from Norse. How do we spot them? Well, palatalization is something that happens in Old English, but not in Old Norse. So remember, palatalization, this is the third of the three sound changes we discussed in Old English. This turns sk into sh, it turns k into ch, and it turns g into y, when there is some kind of high front vowel following it. So we find pairs like Old English, Old Norse has kirkja for a church, and English has the word church, which has a double palatalization in it. That means, interestingly, that English sometimes has both an Old English word and a Norse word borrowed at two different periods. Or rather, in the case of the Old English word, nothing was borrowed. The word shirt, at an earlier period in Old English, before palatalization took place, this would have been skirt. That's a piece of common inheritance among these North Sea Germanic languages. What about the word skirt? Well, that was a later borrowing from Norse. Both languages retained this word. The Old English word underwent palatalization, whereas the Old Norse one didn't. And what happened was that these two versions of the same word ended up simply referring to two different items of clothing. Right? One upper body item of clothing, one lower body item of clothing. So that's why shirt and skirt exist in their current form. Skirt is a borrowing from Norse in English. We similarly have the word skipper in English. So a ship, you know what that is. It's this thing that I showed you on the slide. In Scandinavian languages, this would be a skip, because Scandinavian doesn't have palatalization. So this is a skip. And the person who is in charge of a skip is a skipper. So a skipper is not someone who has a rope and who likes to do the jumping around thing, right? It's someone who's in charge of a ship. And this word we've borrowed from Norse. Sometimes the Old Norse word even takes over from an existing word in West Germanic. So the Germanic word for an egg would have been something like Eggja. Now, this egg, this G, underwent palatalization very broadly, in fact. This is a different type of palatalization that took place much, much earlier, because this is reflected in the German word Ei as well. Right? So this Y, and Old English had this word. Old English had the word A. Remember this. So you get Old English A, and Old Norse, and the word remains egg with a G in it, and that's the word that ends up winning. So the inherited word A, like German I, is lost and replaced by the Norse word. Similarly, the Old English verb niemann, meaning to take, so this is like German nehmen, this is replaced by the Norse word take. So this Norse influence was clearly very, very pervasive. It even caused meaning shifts in the meaning of individual words based on what the equivalent word meant in Norse. So the word dream in Old English just meant joy, right? It meant being happy. And it came through Norse influence to specifically mean some sort of vision that you have while you're sleeping. Similarly, the word for a plough in Old English just meant a measure of land. It's a particular size of area of land. But it comes to be an agricultural instrument, something that you use for ploughing the land. And so, again, the Norse here has influenced the English word in its meaning. And there's a collection of Norse loanwords here. Some of them are very, very basic words. Sky, wrong, mistake, odd, want, take. Very basic words, but still from Norse, which really suggests that this contact situation must have been extremely, extremely intense and really very interesting in the way that it developed. Now, not all of these words were borrowed at the same time. This is really important. The early words, the words that are borrowed into Old English that we have records of in the Old English texts, are from the domains of law and seafaring. So they're legal words, seafaring words. Later loans are the ones that involve basic vocabulary items. So we have at least two phases of Norse loans, and the early ones are in specific domains, the legal domain and the seafaring domain. It's kind of obvious why you would take words from the Scandinavians there, because the Scandinavians were very well known for being good at seafaring, and they were also very well known for being good at law. They had a highly developed legal system compared to the other Germanic peoples at this time. Now, here's a little map of what we see in terms of the place names. What we find is that the place names that come from Norse are particularly common in the northeast of the country. So the place names that end in B, this just means house, abode, somewhere where people live. So Rugby, the place Rugby, is one of these B Germanic names. Similarly, Grimsby. Toft and Thorpe, these are also words that come from Danish. If you see the word Thwaite, there are some places that end in Thwaite, and these are from Norwegian. You can contrast those with the Old English place names, because the Old English place names tend to end with these elements that you see here. So Borough, Ham, Ing, Stow, etc. So the place names give us a big clue about who was where and when. The area that's in yellow here, which is often called the Dane Law, because for a while this area was under its own legal system, a essentially Danish legal system under Danish rule. And so this is the area where the most Danish place names in England are found. Another way that we can see how pervasive this Scandinavian influence was is that we can look at the Old English pronouns. So one thing that I mentioned before was that in Old English you have the third person plural pronouns he, here, hira, and him. Right? They begin with H. That's not what we find in the modern English language. Instead, we find they, their, and them. And these words are usually thought to have come from Scandinavian. So these are Norse borrowings, essentially. Why is this strange? Well, it's not all that unusual for languages to borrow content words, to borrow lexical words like nouns and verbs. But for a language to borrow grammatical words is at least a little bit more striking. And this is why the borrowing of pronouns has often been taken to indicate that the Norse contact situation was really rather special. We can see good evidence that this change probably did originate from Scandinavian in the fact that the shift starts in the north of the country and spreads towards the south. We can see this change spreading during the Middle English period. We will see that over the next two sessions. We also see that the endings on verbs, nouns, and adjectives on the whole start to simplify in the north of the country. So the forms that end in s spread from the north of the country. And this is true both in nouns, so the s plural, and in verbs, so the s in the third person singular. Both of these seem to start out in the north, and this again is consistent with with the hypothesis of Norse influence. When you take writers who were very, very conscious of the varieties that they were using, like Chaucer, so Geoffrey Chaucer, for the third person singular ending, he uses th in his Middle English writings, except when he's representing the speech of Northerners specifically, and then he uses s. So this opposition between th and s was something that Middle English speakers were actually aware of. They could actually tell. They knew about this dialectal variation within their country. We also find things like the complementizer till and the infinitive marker at. And these also are often taken to come from the Scandinavian language directly. So, till he affen up her castles, till they gave up their castles. This is from the Peterborough Chronicle, which is from the year 1137. Similarly, from the Cursor Mundi, a northern text, for the commune at understand. This at is like to in present-day English. This is not an innovation that has survived in the language, except in very specific dialect usage and archaic usage. And there are many other cases that have been proposed to be due to Scandinavian influence in Britain. But the certainty is variable. And again, Miller's book has discussion of a variety of potential cases, but always with language contact, as with everything else, you need to weigh up the arguments and you need to decide for yourself whether you're convinced about the origin. Some of these cases are very clear-cut, others are much, much less so. So those are the three languages we'll be covering today, Celtic, Latin, and Norse, and here's a little overview of the types of influence that we see. From Celtic, we see some influence in the vocabulary, but not as much as we might expect. We don't see any morphological influence, but we do probably see syntactic influence. As for Latin, it's almost the exact opposite. We see vocabulary influence, quite extensive vocabulary influence. Certainly, as far as Old English is concerned, the main language from which Old English borrows words is in fact Latin. But we don't see morphological or syntactic influence. When it comes to Norse, on the other hand, we see influence everywhere. So there's loads of vocabulary. In the first period, it's quite specific vocabulary, seafaring and legal vocabulary. In the second period, it also includes basic vocabulary. And in that second period, we also see morphological change that is probably contact-induced and syntactic change that's probably contact-induced as well. And this tends to spread from the north and east of the country, which is exactly the area that was settled by the Scandinavians during the 9th and 10th centuries in particular. Okay, so these are not the only languages that influence English, of course. Next week, we're going to talk about Anglo-Norman influence and French influence after that. Here are a few other languages that have a few words borrowed into English. So Dutch, we find languages like pickle, deck, and booze. This is towards the end of the Middle English period already. due to Dutch traders who were very powerful and influential. We get Spanish words due to the Spanish influence through large parts of England, through large parts of Europe anyway, not so much in England per se, but words like cork come to English indirectly from Spanish. Many words come from Arabic, in fact, not directly, but again indirectly via languages like Spanish and French. So words like saffron, the admiral as a military rank, average, come from Arabic. And of course, we have some German influence as well. Though the specific type of German influence that we get mostly seems to be from Low German, Plattdeutsch, the German spoken in the Hanseatic League in the north of the country. Because these were the people who were powerful in trade during this early period. So we get words for such wonderful things as marzipan and hamsters. What would we ever do without these words? I do not know. But none of these languages had the fantastically broad influence that we see from Norse, from Scandinavian, or even from Celtic or Latin in this early period. So here is an illustration of something I mentioned earlier. The Middle English speakers were aware of the variation that existed in their language. So Caxton, who introduces the printing press, and we'll get onto that later on, important fact, towards the end of the 15th century, Caxton introduces the printing press. I'll probably ask you about that in your state exam, so write it down. Caxton notes, this is a little story that he's telling about a northern merchant who comes to town, and the northern merchant wants to buy some eggs, and he asks a woman for some eggs. And the woman says, "I'm sorry, I don't speak any French." And then the merchant is pissed off because he also couldn't speak French, but he wanted to have eggs. And then someone had to step in and translate. Someone had to say, "What does this person want?" Eieren is what he wants. Eier. And then, of course, finally, the woman says, "All right, oh, now I get it. Okay, I will give you some eier." But the words, but the problem here is that there's actually a difficulty of communication because the Norse speaker, the northern merchant is using the Norse word eggs, and the southern speakers are using the word eire. And Caxton, of course, has a problem with this. Caxton says, "What should you write if you need to describe these things, you know, little ovals that come out of chickens? Which word do you use? Do you call them eggs or do you call them eieren?" Well, you can't please everyone because of diversity and change of language. And that's still true today. But what Caxton is speculating about at this point is perhaps the need to have a standardized form of the language. And this process of language standardization, which we actually discussed briefly at the very start of the course, is something that we'll come back to when we get onto the early modern English period. But we've already jumped several hundred years into the future now, because we still need to talk about Middle English, about the Middle English language, and that will be the subject of the next two lectures. So you can read the summary for yourself. There is a text. This is the Peterborough Chronicle that I mentioned earlier. This is for you to read during your tutorial, or before your tutorial, ideally. Try and read this, understand it, spot the differences between this text and the earlier Old English texts that you've been using. Also spot the loan words if you can. Next time we'll be back and talking about Middle English, and that's it for today.